Hey, it's Andrew Siciliano. Coming up on Inside Coverage, when will Kansas City wide receiver Rashee Rice be on the field? A big win for John Gruden in court and an ugly day in Jacksonville. That's coming up next. Kind of like the music here. Welcome to another day, friends, of Inside Coverage here on Yahoo and on Yahoo Sports YouTube page from a hotel room somewhere in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. My name is Andrew Siciliano. As we sit here today, everybody synchronized their watches and their calendars. We are exactly 3 weeks away from kickoff 2025. We are 3 weeks away from actually in the same town where I sit right now, not far from where the Eagles and Browns had a joint practice today, at Lincoln Financial Field, the Eagles and the Cowboys will open up the season 3 weeks from today. Charles Robinson, Frank Schwab, gentlemen, please, it cannot get here soon enough.
He says unsarcastically, yes, I agree that 3 weeks. Wow. You put it in that perspective and it's right around the corner. And it just seems like we still have like a million years of the preseason to go. You just get the season here already.
We have a lot to, we're at a point, we still have a lot to sort out. That's what's kind of crazy to me.
Yeah.
You know what, some of the injuries now that have cropped up, now some of the court decisions that have come in now open up a whole nother avenue of, hey, when is this guy now going to get into camp? We're talking about Quinshon Judkins, Isaiah Bond. What's going to happen with Isaiah Bond now? Some quarterback battles that we're still waiting to see sort themselves out. And I was in Jacksonville today, and I'm still wondering how exactly they're going to use Travis Hunter on each side of the ball.
So I'm dying to hear what went down at Jacksonville today. Charles, you were there for their scrimmage. I was at the Browns-Eagles joint practice number two, where Myles Garrett, I believe, had 37 sacks if they were actually keeping track. I think he would have broken the single-season record. Even Steeler fans would admit today that his performance was spectacular. We'll get into that coming up in a second. But Charles, you did kind of teased the entire theme today. This is a little bit of a court TV edition of Inside Coverage. And yes, we have plenty of football sprinkled in again as well. And we have Mike Vrabel once again getting down and dirty and rolling around trying to break up a fight at Patriots camp. Let's get to, however, the stuff off the field, because a lot of the news, especially in the last 90 minutes before we come on the air at 6:30 Eastern time here, is court related. You mentioned Quinshon Judkins. We are closer to a little bit of clarity here for the only remaining unsigned draft pick out of the entire 2025 draft class. That is for any of the 32 teams. The Browns took the running back 36th overall out of Ohio State. He has yet to sign a deal as he was facing charges in Florida for domestic violence. Today, those charges were dropped. No charges against Quinshon Judkins, as Andy Slater initially, Fox in Florida, reported that the state's attorney has determined that there is not enough evidence to move forward. There is a he said, she said aspect to this, and while there were bruises visible, that there was no video evidence of when they were checking into the hotel. Not everything with the story checked out, and they decided that they could not move forward here. So the question now is, does Quinshon Judkins sign? What happens with league discipline? Is there potentially a commissioner's exempt list? The word from Brian McCarthy, the NFL PR head, says this matter is still under investigation. Charles, what do you know on this one?
Yeah, I mean, you know, for the league office, Lisa Friel, still, she's going to handle this. She's, as Brian McCarthy said, the investigation's ongoing. There are times where you can get a grand jury that advances a no bill, which is basically saying, look, we've heard everyone. We don't see something chargeable right now based on the facts that were presented to us, which is the case of what happened with Quinshon Judkins. And, you know, essentially when, you know, you go through that process, then the league steps back and says, okay, we still have oversight here. We can look at this and we can determine if there's something else here that may not be chargeable from a legal standpoint, but does violate some aspect of the personal conduct policy. We can step in and there can be, as you said, a commissioner's exemptless situation. There can be a suspension. That could still happen for Quinshon Judkins. But as of now, as the facts were laid out by the prosecution, or what would have been the prosecution, ultimately you had a scenario where there's two individuals who had their side of the story. There were gaps in timing when they were together, and it led to what I believe they thought would have been reasonable doubt if you would have taken this case forward. It was not viewed as a winnable case, and that's ultimately why charges got dropped. By the way, the Nobel, I apologize, I'm mixing up my cases here. The Nobel was the Isaiah Bond. I will explain that later.
Which we'll get to that.
Judkins was just
coming up in a second.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Too many court cases coming in the last 30
Browns,
minutes.
Too many Browns court case.
Yeah, well, only
too
one many Browns is off the field issues. Technically, right? Neither
only
is.
Only one's a Brown, Frank.
Right now.
Frank?
Technically. Yeah. Neither is.
Only one was drafted by the Browns, Frank. Okay. So stop
all right.
It.
Well, yeah. There's one team that this always comes up with. Real quick, I'm not going to get into legal stuff. Charles did a good job of that right there. But I do think that it's worth saying, as you talked about, Charles, this doesn't mean that Judkins is going to be like starting running back week one. Like, even if the NFL does nothing in this, they just say, okay, you're fine. No suspension because the charges were dropped. Basically, the train has left the station. Like, we've had all of camp. But even correct. If he signs tonight, he's not going to get any practices this week. Obviously not going to play in a preseason game this week. All of a sudden, you're in the third week of preseason. He's not going to be ramped up enough to even play in the third preseason game, I wouldn't doubt. Again, the train has left the station. Maybe Judkins can be a contributor at some point this year. I highly doubt it. It's probably it's just a kind of a lost year for him, maybe late in the year, but to miss an entire camp like this, you're not going to contribute much. And the NFL could still come in and suspend him.
I would push back against that, Frank, because he was in the entire offseason program. He was there, rookie minicamp, OTAs, mandatory minicamp. I agree with you. Week one seems to be, you know, that would be wishful thinking.
I think it's
going to
be a tough transition for any rookie in this. I agree.
I understand that.
I get what you're saying. I just think it's going to be a tough thing for him to get really acclimated and be a what they expected him to be.
You just don't know what the league discipline, if any league discipline comes down, will be. And that is the question mark now. So let's assume that he eventually comes in, maybe even next week, signs his contract. Then how does the league respond? Do you automatically put him on the commissioner's exempt list? Do you wait? Is the investigation still continuing from Lisa Friel and the league office? All of these remain unanswered. If everything magically went away tomorrow, yes, I'm with you. Week one, unlikely big time contributor, but he was with the team through the entirety of the offseason program and mandatory minicamp. He has Jerome Ford in front of him, Dylan Sampson in front of him right now. Pierre Strong is here. But before this happened, he was atop the depth chart. But there are still at this point many, many unanswered questions as to how the no longer legal process, but the league disciplinary process will play out.
And I want to put something else in play here. If this was, and again, this isn't to minimize anything. I'm just trying to make an example of when someone sits out. Had it been a hamstring injury, right, that kept him out through, you know, into the third week of training camp. If a player returns from a hamstring injury, there's a ramp up process, and that player they're not lost for the season, right? They're fine. Like he's absolutely, I think, depending on when he gets back in, there will be a ramp up process. You have to be careful because I think, particularly when running backs, wide receivers, corners, when they sit out, especially guys that are tuned, when they sit out a long period of time in the preseason, soft tissue issues are almost always the first thing that hit at some point. So you just want to go through that process where you're very careful. You don't throw a ton at him and you let him work himself into shape. Does that mean he starts to factor in October? Possibly. Does that mean, you know, maybe further into October? I just would not see it as a lost season. I mean, there's nothing here, given all the other work that he's done, what they had planned for him prior to this. And again, it's not an injury that he's returning from. I still think he's going to be a large, large part of that offense once he gets in there.
Yeah, a lot of we don't knows, at least at the moment. And we also don't know what's going to happen with Isaiah Bond. Let's get to that one. For those unfamiliar with Isaiah Bond, he was basically a top 50 to top 100, depending on who you whose rankings you look at before the draft. Wide receiver coming out of Texas, started Alabama, and then went to UT. Obviously, Matthew Golden went in the first round from that wide receiver room at Texas. He went to the Green Bay Packers. Isaiah Bond wasn't drafted, however, because in early April, there was a sexual assault allegation against him in Texas. He sued, claiming defamation. That got thrown out. Fast forward to today, Isaiah Bond without a football team, and prosecutors in Texas, Charles, back to your no bill thing, issued a no bill, meaning we've decided to not pursue this case further because we do not believe that we could prosecute this case and get a conviction before a jury. So no bill, Isaiah Bond basically cleared, free now of his legal issues. Isaiah Bond shortly thereafter posted on Instagram and on Twitter that he would like to thank Jimmy Haslam, owner of the Cleveland Browns, and that he is going to sign with the Browns. He's not signing with the Browns today. That is not going to happen. Mary Kay Cabot, beat writer, Cleveland.com, used to be known as the Plain Dealer, reports tonight that the Browns have done due diligence. They certainly liked him as a football player coming out of the draft. And when you run a 4-3 or whatever, and you make big plays for the Texas Longhorns, certainly you're going to like him. However, don't believe what Isaiah Bond is selling right now. Mary Kay Cabot says that while the Browns have certainly looked into it, they are not signing him today. So maybe the player jumped the gun here. Regardless, he is talented. Somebody will sign him. Charles, it might be the Browns, but right now they're pushing back against that.
Well, I mean, Andrew, who's the offensive coordinator of the Browns, right? There's a connection there. So, I mean, I think there's no doubt that he would like to play, you know, for the Browns. And frankly, you could argue there's a need for the Browns. I think the Browns could use depth at wide receiver. And as you said, he was a player who, you know, I think there were varying opinions on him in the draft, but I feel like his basement in the draft was a third round pick, right? And there were certainly teams that I think would have liked to have taken a look at him maybe later in the second round. A guy who's got speed, you know, not a ton of size. I mean, in terms of height, you know, he's like a 5'11 guy, but he does have that 4'4 sub 4'4 speed, which is that'll get you a lot of shots in the NFL, and that will definitely drive you up draft boards. Played big roles at two programs when you talk about Alabama and Texas. So I think for him, this is frankly the best possible outcome of this, right? I mean, to have fallen out of the draft when you could have been, you know, I think, again, the basement on you was really a third round assessment. To have fallen completely out of the draft is rare. And I think in those instances, it causes particularly the maybe some teams that haven't done their full due diligence, but I think all kind of knew what was at the table at that point. Causes everybody to sit there and go, okay, this is really serious, because especially when you get in those later rounds, you do have franchises that are like, we'll take a shot and see exactly what's going to unfold here legally, and you know, maybe burn a seventh round draft pick. Teams didn't even want to do that in this situation. So for him to get the no bill and move forward and now have an opportunity to talk to teams, you know, and now move forward into his NFL career is about the best he possibly could have asked for. And I have no doubt that I'd be shocked if he was not signed by a team by the time we have the first week of the season rolls around.
Yeah, absolutely. You go from, like you said, it is interesting that he fell completely out of the draft, that not one team would even use a seventh rounder on him. But yes, teams will be lining up. He has the talent. You're basically getting at worst, a third round pick kind of for free now, if he can live with the PR hits and all that kind of stuff. And if you've done your due diligence, and we'll see which team it is. But yes, he gets to choose where he goes now. And instead of some team using a seventh round pick on him, and there's honestly probably teams that are like, we should have just used a seventh round pick on him and lived with the result one way or another, because only one gets to sign him now.
You mentioned the connection there, Charles, just buttoning that up. But Tommy Rees, offensive coordinator for the Browns year, was the OC 2 years ago for Alabama. Last year, he was the Browns tight end coach. This year, bumped up to OC. So, yes, there is a connection there. I promise this entire show is not going to be about courts and discipline. I promise. However, let's talk about Rashee Rice, because we find out now today, Charles, the date of Rashee Rice's hearing, his disciplinary hearing. He is in front of Sue L. Robinson, the federal judge who, when last we heard her name, was ruling for an 11-game suspension with Deshaun Watson. Disciplinary hearing is now set for September 30th, which means the Chiefs will play four games before Rashee Rice has his hearing. They'll go to Brazil to play the Chargers. They'll play the Eagles. They'll go to the Giants. And then they'll play the Baltimore Ravens on week four. And then the following Tuesday, Rashee Rice gets his hearing. Now, some Chiefs fans may go, that's great. We get Rashee Rice the first month of the season. Yes. However, let's say Sue L. Robinson takes 2 weeks to make her decision, which is what happened, oh, by the way, in the Deshaun Watson case a couple of years ago. And then let's say it's a multiple-game suspension. The Chiefs could be looking at the second half of this season without their number one target at wide receiver.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, this is really something that the Chiefs wanted to have buttoned up. You know, they did not want to be dealing with this in the middle of the schedule. You know, they, I mean, I think they were fine with, look, the process is what it is. You know, we need to go through this, but they didn't want it to be now a scenario where they're sitting there going, okay, great. Well, we have our number one wide receiver. And as you said, and it, and I don't see a lot of people pointing that out, but it's very poignant. We don't know. She's, there's no, there's nothing pushing her to have to make an expedient decision. So it's not like she has to turn around in 24, 48 hours, you know, 72 hours and have something for the league and the Kansas City Chiefs. So, yeah, I mean, you absolutely could get them for four games. And then, you know, by the time she makes her decision, maybe you're into week six or seven, and you don't know what the scope of that decision is going to be, too. I mean, there are some teams, you know, when I've talked to teams, particularly when it first initially happened, because I got into discussions about sort of his background when he went into the NFL draft, and talked to some teams just kind of about, you know, the racing that's occurred with cars and whatnot and players. And I had a couple general managers who said to me, there has definitely been a, the league office, the way they have handled speed related incidents with cars. And I think it even goes back to what happened with Henry Ruggs in Las Vegas with the fatality. They are really pushing to have a decision that sends out a clear message to players that if this is going to continue, the kind of suspensions you're going to get are going to be extremely drastic. So there's a chance here that Rice's suspension could be far more expansive than maybe people are expecting, maybe double digit games. And if that happens and all of a sudden it comes down in week six or seven or eight,
double digit, really?
That then is, I think some teams feel like the league office, particularly when it's a case of vehicles being involved, speed being involved, and then other individuals' lives being threatened by what then transpires, right? And this was a crash in Texas on the highway. It involved multiple individuals. People were hurt. And then, you know, Rashee Rice and other individuals then left the scene after this happened. And, you know, I think the league was staring at this like, they're taking this very, very seriously. I think they were extremely upset with how it really unfolded. And again, I would not be surprised if this ends up being a lengthy suspension that maybe people are not necessarily expecting. I think some people think, oh, it could just be four games. I don't know. I think it go a little further than maybe what people think.
Oh, sorry, Frank. Let me get the charges in here. So he was sentenced to 30 days. Rashee Rice in jail and 5 years probation. Yep. It was a multi-car crash, as you said, Charles, in Dallas. He pleaded guilty, Rice did, in district court in Texas to 2 third-degree felony charges, collision involving serious bodily injury and racing on a highway causing bodily injury. So it's not just a speeding ticket. This was legit. Right. And then Charles, as you mentioned, he, you know, there's a video of him and his friends walking away down the highway.
Yeah, the league, what they consider this is, it's an offense with multiplying factors. That's one of these things that I think when they're starting to look at when someone runs afoul of the personal conduct policy or gets convicted of a felony, it's who else was involved here? Like, you know, were other people's lives put in danger? I think they consider that to be the multiplying factor, and that's why I think you could have a far more steep punishment than maybe some people are expecting. And as you point out, as this pushes out, if all of a sudden that punishment is coming down week seven or eight, and it's expansive, you could be looking at the Chiefs having a whole entire second half of the season without Rashee Rice as their wide receiver one.
Yeah, I was just going to say that football wise, I assume the Chiefs, like you said, would rather get this wrapped up right away. If it's going to be six games, let's just do the first six games. That's fine. But also, you do look at the schedule and you say, they got the Chargers week one. It's a huge divisional game. Week two is the Eagles. Week four is the Ravens, a game that could decide, who knows, the number one seed in the AFC. If I'm the Ravens, I'm like, Rashee Rice gets to play against us. You can't fit this guy in your schedule before September 30th? Really? Like, I don't know. I don't know that the Chiefs would, it's not ideal, but at the same time, the Chiefs are probably like, so we get Rashee Rice for the Chargers, Eagles, and the Ravens. It's not too bad. I guess there's a trade-off there. But yeah, ultimately, of course, yes, you'd like to get this done, just get it done with. And then by week seven or whatever, you know you have Rashee Rice for the rest of the season. But I'm with you, Charles, too. I think it's going to be longer than four games. I think there's a lot of circumstances here.
And if this is extreme, I mean, if you're the, you know, the Chiefs, you're like, well, we'd probably rather have them facing the Chargers and Eagles in January than having them facing them in September. So I don't know that it would be that extreme that you were talking about taking them off the field into playoff games. But yeah, I get the point you're making.
Yeah, there's this, I think, at least I just assumed, and you're always wrong to assume, right, that this would be figured out sometime in the summer. They would figure it out. You'd have a suspension, whatever, before you got to week one. And then when I heard the news today, we got to wait till September 30th. I could just hear like all the fans who hate the Chiefs, right, who think it's rigged for the Chiefs. By the way, it isn't, friends. Pipe down, okay? Calm down. Going, oh, great. Now Mahomes gets from the first month of the season, then he's going to get a couple of games, and that's it. They're doing him a favor. In essence, I don't know that they are doing the Chiefs a favor. He's going to get some kind of suspension, logic dictates, at some point. And if this thing drags on, and then you just hit him for that stretch run the second half of the year, that is far from ideal. I promise, as mentioned, this is not going to be a court TV show. However, legal, Charles Robinson will unpack what the arbitration ruling means, or the John Gruden case means, Brian Flores case means as well, because it could upend the entire way the league hands down discipline. And yes, there is football. Mike Vrabel gets in a scrum. Browns Eagles joint practice report, and Charles will unpack everything he saw today in Jacksonville. Charles, Frank, I'm Andrew. This is Inside Coverage. Inside Coverage here on Yahoo and YouTube on the Yahoo Sports Channel. My name is Andrew Siciliano. That is Frank Schwab. That over there is Charles Robinson. Although, hold on, I should be pointing this way. Yeah, whatever. I don't know. I'm all screwed up in my hotel room trying to figure out which way I'm pointing because I'm looking at the camera, not looking down at the monitor. We have the Rashee Rice story, the Quinshon Judkins story, and the Isaiah Bond story. This is going to get a little bit in the weeds here, but this is important. And let me explain to the average NFL fan why it is important. It has to do, guys, with arbitration. And the league basically has a system that if you are disciplined and you appeal, the appeal very often goes to the commissioner. Now, there are also appeals officers, right, that the league has as well, usually former players. But very often the final appeal can go all the way up to Roger Goodell. John Gruden and Brian Flores both have pending cases. When it comes to Gruden, he claims that the league released or leaked emails and that led to his firing with the Raiders. He has a suit in Nevada. Brian Flores has a suit as well. He couldn't get a head coaching job after the Dolphins fired him. In both cases, Charles, there are now rulings pushing back against the concept that Roger Goodell, or the head of any corporation, as the final arbiter of discipline within that structure, doesn't work. Take it from there.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So you have, I mean, what people need to understand is when both Gruden and Flores brought these lawsuits, the way the NFL responded was, okay, sure, you want to bring those lawsuits? No problem. Run them through our arbitration systems. You know, you're part of the NFL. The arbitration system exists and it you know, covers everyone in the league, including coaches. And both Gruden and Flores said, that's improper. We are not covered by this collectively bargained process that really you use with players. When players are trying to appeal things, We should not be subject to that. And if we feel like our rights are being violated, we should be able to go through the normal court system for some type of restitution. The NFL has argued against that. You've had both cases have run their course through different court systems, appeals courts. They've kicked up at various levels of legal systems. And what you got was the Nevada Supreme Court stepped in and said, nope, we are ruling in favor of Gruden in that, as what Andrew said, you cannot have an arbitration system in which you're going to force John Gruden to go through it. And the ultimate arbiter is one of the individuals he is effectively accusing of wrongdoing. And thus John Gruden should be allowed to move forward in normal fashion with his lawsuit, which would if it moves forward in that realm in through the federal court system, you're going to look at it as the process of discovery, the process of actually having a jury trial where people, if it convenes, we'll have to sit and testify. Basically, it's open kimono for the NFL when it comes to the John Gruden case in the fashion which the Nevada Supreme Court has now pushed it. It's the same. There was an appellate court that effectively handed down a very similar ruling for Brian Flores, coming to the same conclusion. You cannot force this individual into an appeals system, an arbitration system in which the ultimate arbiter is someone that he's pointing a finger at when it comes to the hiring practices. So your case can also move forward in a normal legal fashion. Now, the NFL is going to appeal both. And eventually, I think if the NFL has to push it that far, it will go to the U.S. Supreme Court. If the NFL, you know, they are prepared to take it ultimately that far. Now, if let's say the U.S. Supreme Court either says, hey, the lower courts were correct, we're not taking this case up, and now this would be further down the line. That means that, you know, Flores and Gruden win their cases, and the NFL now has to go to court unless they decide, hey, we want to settle. We don't want to go through this discovery process. But it's going to affect the NFL's arbitration system, because the league now has to sit there and look at this and say, this has been a huge legal battle right now with these coaches, and we have to look and be forward thinking and know that if we want them in that arbitration system, we're going to have to bargain that. There's going to have to be something in place that gives us the power to push them very clearly in writing through the arbitration system rather than through a normal court system. So it's the NFL as a league not wanting to air its dirty laundry is on the verge with these two lawsuits of being put in a situation where a lot of dirty laundry could ultimately get aired. Or at the very least, people are going to be poking around in emails and other documents and you know, talking to people under oath in ways that I think would make the league uncomfortable.
Charles, I just want to ask you real quick, what do you think the odds are that these guys just play it out? Because the NFL's playbook on it, look, and the NFL's arbitration process has always been kind of trash, and they overstep their bounds. We all know that. But I think a lot of people, how this is going to appeal to people is, oh, the NFL is going to have to release all these emails and discovery. This is all going to be public information. Wow. Okay. How likely do you think it is Gruden and or Flores say, I don't want your settlement check. I want you to get aired out in court. That's what I want. Because Gruden, I think, has said that. This case has gone on so long that I can't remember it. But I do remember a quote at the beginning of basically Gruden saying, and I'm paraphrasing in a very general way, hey, my coaching career in the NFL is probably over anyway. I just want to get the right NFL in court and embarrass them. So how likely do you think it is that it goes to that? Because everybody settles. Hey, Kaepernick, that was the one. I was like, oh, they're going to go to court. And then Kaepernick settled. I was like, oh, that's disappointing. Right. How likely do you think it is?
Also, Jim Trotter from the NFL Network as well. I mean, that was another one that never advanced to court, and there was a settlement between Jim and the NFL. So there has been, recent instances, at least in the last, you know, 6-7 years of seeing the league, you know, settle some of these cases. And in terms of Gruden, I can tell you, I remember when it started, and, you know, I was talking to a number of people that were close to John. And it was a lot of emotion at that time. And what I was told straight up is, this is scorched earth. Like, he's going all the way. It's not about money. They cannot write a check big enough to get him to go away in this instance. This is about pride. And the reaction I got was, John has money. It's not about, you know, being richer than he is right now. It's about him feeling like, you know, there's an element of justice here, and he was wronged, and he wants people to you know, be held accountable ultimately for that. And I think there's an element of that with Flores as well. You know, so but I will say this, I have no doubt whatsoever that if this gets into the point of where discovery is going to open or where this is getting pushed into, you know, a courtroom in front of a jury, I would be stunned if the NFL does not attempt at the very least to write a check and get this handled rather than go forward and have people rooting through emails. And, you know, at least in the Gruden case, whoever leaked the emails to the media that ultimately led to John Gruden's firing, that will come out. It's almost impossible that would not come out in discovery. So if that's an individual at 345 Park Avenue, it is in the NFL's best interest to make sure they obscure that individual's identity in any way possible. And the way to do it would be through money.
We should also note here that the arbitration system sometimes does get a win for the aggrieved party here. For example, Terry McDonough, former personnel executive of the Arizona Cardinals, he sued the Cardinals, and that went to arbitration, and Roger Goodell appointed an arbitrator. Jeffrey Mishkin was the arbitrator, and what McDonough alleged was that the Cardinals defamed him, right? They said bad things about him after he was let go. He went after them. He won in arbitration. He won a $3 million judgment. So you can win, but what Gruden and Flores both argue is that this shouldn't be the forum to determine my grievance.
And I would say, you know, when you look at the goal and the aim in the McDonough case, it was very much focused on an owner and a general manager. Mm-hmm. This is like the NFL is in the crosshairs here. The system of how they do business is in the crosshairs here. And the league office is very much in the crosshairs here. To me, it's the scale of something like that. And I almost wonder if that's what kept this ultimately from going, the courts looking at this and ruling, yes, that can be pushed into the arbitration system. I almost wonder if it's the scale that the court looks at and says, you know, you're going after everything here. When you're going after everything, you can't tuck that into an arbitration system that realistically is really meant for much smaller scale issues. It's very rare for lawsuits of these magnitudes and the individuals who are there are essentially being pulled into the lawsuits in terms of plaintiffs. It's unusual to see heavy hitters and the system itself and how a league does business tucked into an arbitration system. I have to believe that had to have weighed in on some of these decisions.
Do you guys want to talk football? Can we do that? You guys want to get to football?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. Okay. Legal Eagles fly away. We'll actually talk about the Eagles coming up next. What I saw here today in Philadelphia is the Eagles get their second day of working against the Browns, and equally as important and as exciting, what Charles saw today at a less than crisp, let's call it that way, Jaguars scrimmage in Jacksonville. We will discuss football in a football show coming up next on Inside Coverage. And now for something completely different. We'll talk about football. Welcome back to Inside Coverage, everybody. Frank Schwab, that is Charles Robinson. My name is Andrew Siciliano here at 6:30 Eastern Time every day, Monday through Friday. That is here as we are 3 weeks away from the regular season opener, the kickoff opener here in Philadelphia, the Eagles and the Cowboys. We'll get to that a little bit later. Let's talk about the Jaguars because Charles is now, unlike yesterday, has anyone noticed, positioned in front of the other bed in his Jacksonville hotel room.
Why you gotta bring that up?
No, I think, look, that's a trick of the trade. Like, there's a curtain behind you, Charles. We are taking the viewer behind that curtain, literally and figuratively, to show you how the sausage is.
It's the perfect segue because, like this half of the room, the Jaguars were a mess today.
Okay. So
we couldn't just keep them off camera. we couldn't keep it. Yeah.
It was that bad?
It was it was extremely hot. And so they had a high intensity scrimmage today, which is basically let's take the ones and let's run the ones against the ones. Let's run the twos against the twos, the threes against the threes. And, you know, it's not going to be, you know, full game, you know, speed and hitting and everything, but it's going to be close, right? They've got to go play the New Orleans Saints in week 2 of that exhibition season. And I think they really wanted to get a measurement of where they were at. You know, I think there were 7 drop passes today and the penalties were in the double digits. So it was certainly not clean in any respect. And, you know, there was even a moment where, you know, downfield Travis Hunter dove for a ball that was certainly out of reach for him. He landed really hard and kind of laid on the ground there for a second. And I'm just, you know, I'm like, oh my God, this is going to go from rough to extremely problematic for them. But he did pop up, he shook it off, he was okay. But you know, you can see when you look at the offense right now and you talk to people in the building, there's still a level of absorption of Liam Cohen's system that Trevor Lawrence is going through right now. And I do think one of the things that they're happy about is his discipline as far as his mechanics. They can see it's gotten better already. And that was certainly something he did for Baker Mayfield in Tampa Bay. And it's nice to hear because, you know, Trevor Lawrence being tall, you know, you have a big wingspan. Quarterbacks like that can sometimes get loose with their mechanics, and that's how balls end up sailing. You're a little off, your placement's not perfect. But if you can get to the point where you're really, you know, you're disciplined, you have a compact throwing motion, your feet are where they're supposed to be. That was something Lawrence talked about today, is now it's become second nature. He's not thinking about how he's supposed to be planting his feet in, you know, shotgun formations or sometimes when he's throwing on platform. So he's feeling the progress. But again, in this practice, you could see there's still a ways to go in terms of just how seamless this runs and how clean it's going to be. But it's better that it's happening now on August 14th than be talking about this, say, on August 28th, right? They still have time, I think, to continue to get this on the rails.
I don't like hearing this about my AFC South championship pick, the Jaguars. This is
they were 4-13 last year, Frank. But
hey, you gotta be out on some limbs, right, boys? So, but really, what I we got to ask, contractually obligated to ask, how did they use Travis Hunter today? I know you said maybe that limited him a little bit, the hard fall he took. How are they using him? Did they use him kind of like the preseason game where it was like, oh, first team offense, second team defense? Okay, now we can figure out a little bit about his usage.
So he began with defensive snaps today. Like it was primarily he was out there with the defense initially, but they did rotate him. He got good usage, but when I had a chance to speak to somebody in the building about where this whole thing was going forward with Travis. And, you know, two things that I thought were really interesting is he agreed the data set for how much he can be used is there's no real data set right now because you have to throw out Colorado. What happened in college gave him the opportunity to step in the NFL and try to play on both sides of the ball, try to start on both sides of the ball and play a high number of snaps. But because the NFL's level of intensity and study and speed and all these other things are different, it corrupts that entire data set. Now it's like they're building the data set now. They're watching now. They're studying the GPS now, and they're learning really what the true data set is ultimately going to be. And I would argue they won't really have it until they're halfway through the season or maybe through the full 2025 season will they actually understand how exactly they can rotate him. And the second thing that the person I was speaking to talked about and really hit me was, you know, they're going to use the rotation in the best way possible that affords them the ability to win games. And to do that, sometimes you have to put an opposing team off kilter, whether it's offensively or defensively. So you have opponents who come in going, okay, well, based on the first 3 weeks of the season or 4 weeks or whatever, this is what we're going to get from Travis Hunter. But the Jaguars decide, no, you know what? 85% of his usage is going to be on the defensive side of the ball, and the opponent's not prepared for that. Or 100% of the usage is going to be on the offensive side of the ball. And again, that's a mismatch that you create that maybe the opponent isn't necessarily expecting. So it's just interesting to see how they're really working through this. And the last thing I'll leave you with, and this blew my mind because I had never thought about it. James Gladstone, the general manager there, they're they love their data. They love, you know, pulling together a million threads to really come up with, you know, all these different aspects of how they want to move forward culturally and with players. And right now with Travis Hunter, something that resonates in their building is if they pull this off successfully, they'll be the only team in the NFL that has proprietary information and a system that they created on their own of how to actually handle a two-way player in the NFL, which then would allow them effectively to move forward and say, can we find a second two-way player in the NFL? Is there someone else out there in the college ranks? If Hunter resonates and you start to have younger players on the college level say, hey, I want to play two ways, well, the Jaguars technically would be ahead of the curve because they're the first ones who are really doing it on this scale. And everything they're learning and refining right now is going to be something they can use to their advantage down the road.
You know, it is interesting because it's like saying, hey, I have a unicorn. I have a pet unicorn. So now I know what other pet unicorns could potentially look like
if
I were to find another pet unicorn. But, you know, James Gladstone has said, and Andrew Berry, who obviously worked with him and to make the deal, Browns GM, they have both said, others have said as well, people at the pro day, for example, at Boulder, the guy doesn't get tired. Like, he could run 115 right. plays, he doesn't get tired. Everybody agrees that can't happen to the NFL. Bucky Brooks, friend of the program, NFL Network draft analyst, and also the Jaguars sideline reporter. He was up in the booth doing color in the preseason TV broadcast as well. You know, Bucky has noted that the offensive side of the ball that people thought would just be easy. I mean, you could say he's wide receiver one. It is a transition right. for Travis Hunter because, hey, we're not just holding Absolutely. Up cards on the sideline like you're in Boulder, right? You don't just have like a reasonably simple route tree where he's the focal point of the offense yeah. anyway, right? Shador, look right. There's Travis yeah. throwing the ball. Not that everything is that simple. Please don't misunderstand me. But that when you're trying to assimilate on both sides of the ball as a rookie, it's not the physical, excuse me, that is anyway going to slow down Travis Hunter. It's just the
right.
overwhelming nature of learning the intricacies, Frank, of both sides of the ball.
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, the challenge is there, but I've said this before and again. And again, I readily admit that I'm just rooting for this to happen because I think it Same. Would be awesome.
Absolutely.
I love watching Shohei Ohtani. I mean, like, guys this special are fun to watch. So maybe I'm allowing myself to be corrupted by that. But you said, Charles, and I completely disagree. I get these guys are smarter than me. They're more advanced than me, all that. But to say we can't use any of the data from him doing this at Colorado, it doesn't matter. It does matter. Everything is based on
here's
what we see in college football. Why?
Here's why. So I'll give you an anecdote here. Marvin Harrison Jr., when I went through Arizona earlier in the camp tour, right, and I go through and I'm talking to Drew Petzing, their offensive coordinator, and I'm saying, okay, so Marvin came in bigger. I get it. You know, there's – but, you know, explain to me, what are you doing with him right now? And let's remember, Marvin Harrison Jr. spent all his time at Ohio State and his entire life basically becoming a technician as a wide receiver. What they're working on with Marvin Harrison Jr. right now is, hey, fighting for the ball at the point of attack. Hey, at the top of your route, you have to be more of a technician because, hey, Marv, you know, you're decently fast, but you're not 4.4 fast. So you're not going to get open just with pure speed. You have to be like, you know, now Ladd McConkey's fast, but he is an extreme route technician at the top of his routes. So they're working on all this with Marvin Harrison Jr. Now consider that this is a guy who played at Ohio State. His father's a Hall of Fame wide receiver. Every single thing, every element in his life you would expect would lead to him walking into the NFL being a fully complete product, and he's not. And that's what the Arizona Cardinals are working with right now, saying, this is different on the NFL level. You can get by with other things on the college level, but now you have to totally remix it because, you know, your speed, you have to do other things to make up for the speed. Your size, and when the ball is thrown to you, it's not a Minnesota cornerback on you anymore, right? It's not a gopher who's fighting you for the ball, who might be 5'8 and 170 pounds. It's a completely different scenario. So now you look at Travis. It's the same scenario on both sides of the ball. And then on top of that, it's the physicality of it. What will the physicality take out of him? And I would say when I watched him hit the ground today in practice, that to me is what starts to rule out the Colorado data set, because this is a guy who's going to take punishment diving for balls. He's going to take punishment trying to tackle running backs coming out of the backfield. And the level of punishment on the NFL is so different that I think it dramatically impacts the amount of stamina you can sustain. And by the way, your overall health long term in this game. So it's, again, the Colorado stuff was great, but it just proved to NFL teams, hey, he definitely deserves the opportunity to try to do this on this level. But in terms of the management of it, they have to create that data all over again.
Very much a work in progress here. As we transition to the Eagles and the Browns today, one last note on Marvin Harrison Jr. He is the one player that truly made me feel old. I did an Ohio State game a couple of years ago for NBC. The Buckeyes were in Purdue. They were in West Lafayette to play the Boilermakers. And during our production meeting, it hit me. And I told Marvin in the moment, hey, dude, this is going to sound crazy. I was at Syracuse with your father. I called on the radio your father catching touchdown passes. If you score on Saturday, like, this will be a full circle moment where I will truly feel like an old man. And of course, he scored. And
that's awesome.
It's awful.
Did you see the picture today of because obviously the Cardinals are in Denver. Peyton Manning was at practice. Marvin Harrison and Peyton Manning taking a selfie together. That's just so full circle. Like, Peyton was probably like, yeah, kid, I remember you running around the locker room. Like, yeah, there's some players.
You talk more than
when you attach a junior to their name, it's like, oh, I feel old. Wow. Yeah.
Wow. I felt old standing out in the heat today in Philadelphia because, boy, was it steaming. Again today, second day of joint practice, Browns Eagles, much shorter than day one. I'm happy to report there were no fights day two, which normally is what happens, especially on a hot and humid day on the second day of a joint practice. Much like yesterday, the defense won the day. I promise you I'm not here as a Browns homer, but Myles Garrett had like 37 sacks. At one point, it looked like he had a sack on consecutive plays deep into practice. He didn't get the second one. And on the subsequent play, when Jalen Hurts in a hurry up threw a fade to the corner of the end zone, Miles just kind of stood there with his hands out like, why are we running this play? That was a sack. Denzel Ward had a great PBU. Let me say this as well. And again, you can accuse me of being a Browns homer. I thought Denzel Ward might have been the third best player on the field today for either team. Saquon looks like Saquon, but really tough to gauge a running game where you're not going live, not tackling in a joint practice. Denzel Ward last year led the NFL with 19 PBUs. He wasn't first team all pro because he didn't have the picks. That was DPOY, Patrick Surtain, and that was Derek Stingley. But Denzel Ward is playing as well as he has played, I think, in his entire career. Keep an eye on a huge season for him. As for the Browns quarterback situation, Shedeur Sanders was in uniform, all right? So he wasn't back at the hotel getting treatment. He's in all likelihood not going to play this Saturday. Joe Flacco is not going to play. So fingers crossed that Dylan Gabriel wakes up tomorrow morning and he feels good. He went out there, worked with the second team, a little bit with the first as well, but most of that was Joe Flacco today. And if his hamstring feels good, then he will be good to go Saturday for the Browns and the Eagles at Lincoln Financial. If he is not, and they play it super cautious, which would be understandable, then guys, get ready for four full quarters national TV broadcast of Tyler Snoop Huntley.
Snoop-a-loop.
Oh boy, yeah, the Browns. Yeah. I mean, I love Snoop. I don't want to make the joke of saying that'll sell tickets, but I mean, it's definitely a different vibe to it than the Carolina opener. Andrew, I have one question. What do you think if Gabriel plays in this game, comparatively when it came to Shedeur, what do you think they are expecting to see? What do they want to see out of Dylan Gabriel? Is it the same thing as Shedeur? Do you just want to see a comfort level? Do you want to see, okay. The thing about Shedeur that was so great in that first game was they saw him in like 15 different scenarios. It was all these different, you know, he's throwing from his end zone. He's sneaking the ball. He's running. He's avoiding pressure.
Sudden change.
He's sidestepping. Yeah. Everything. Right. Yeah. So are you just, are the Browns sitting there going, let's just see that. Let's see him put through every kind of scenario and how he reacts.
I think they would say that what they want to see is a clean operation, like for any rookie quarterback. Can you get the play out in the huddle? Can you get to the line? Can you get lined up? Can you get your motions
speed
right? Can you set your protections? Yeah. Can you identify your blitzes? Can you play the game cleanly? Avoid the pre-snap penalties. Look like you are in control of the operation. Shador did that last week, certainly. Dylan Gabriel, with his 6 years of college starting experience at UCF and at Oklahoma and at Oregon, you would hope he can do that as well. I know people love to go quarterback tracker at practice. I can tell you today that those numbers have no context, don't include like a Dylan Gabriel two-point conversion, a nice ball, a beautiful layered pass to Harold Fannin. He looked pretty good today. The Browns offense much better today than it was yesterday. But Charles, to answer your question as we go to break here, it just got to be a clean operation. And I think if they can get that, then that's a step in the right direction for any quarterback in the preseason, but especially for a rookie quarterback. Coming up next, a veteran quarterback, an update on Matthew Stafford's back from L.A. And Mike Vrabel gets down and dirty again. Inside coverage on Yahoo. It's Inside Coverage here on Yahoo. Frank Schwab, Charles Robinson. My name is Andrew Siciliano. I said there were no fights today in Philadelphia. Day two joint practice. However, can I interest you in Mike Vrabel getting down and dirty again? Last week at Patriots practice, he broke up a fight and came away bloodied on his cheek. Look at Vrabel, guys. Frank, look at Vrabel actually on the ground rolling around.
Fellas, if we had a battle royal of all NFL coaches, Vrabel wins, right? Who am I? And that's Dan Campbell. Maybe those two at the final. I know Mike McDaniel's the first one out, but
I mean, I think it's Vrabel. He's just crazy. Right?
This is awesome.
Man, I don't know. There's no respect on, you know, Pete's kind of wiry. He's got, you know, but he's
77
year old muscle. He's all muscle and energy. What about Tomlin? You just going to throw Tomlin out of this?
Tomlin's a good one. He'd be in there.
I would take Vrabel and Campbell over Tomlin. Yes, I think it's going to sound. I think they're at top of their fitness game. Let's just say that.
Does Jim Harbaugh not strike you as, you know, the movies where you would see like the, you know, oh, in the early 1900s, like, where they would chalk on the floor and then the two guys would just stand there and keep punching each other in the face? That is Jim Harbaugh. I'm like, Jim's 100% crazy enough, that baby, guy
to be in there.
All right, we're short on time. I'm going to transition by saying I think Sean McVay is pretty good as well. He's still built. He's jacked. He works out all the time. And I think, low man wins. It's all about leverage. I would put McVay into it. And that's how we transition into Matthew Stafford is going to try to test out his sore back again. Fingers crossed. He's going to try to work that back out on Saturday. And then if he is good to go, then maybe, just maybe, he's able to practice next week. That's it. We're done. For Frank Schwab, Charles Robinson, my name is Andrew Siciliano. This is Inside Coverage, 6:30 Eastern Time, every Monday through Friday. We will be back. So long, everybody.